Here's a piece of good advice. Think it over once or twice. Be kind to your parents, though they don't deserve it. Remember, they're grown-ups, a difficult stage of life. They're apt to be nervous and overexcited, confused from their daily storm and strife. Just keep in mind, though it sounds hard, I know, most parents once were children long ago. Incredible, so treat them with patience and sweet understanding, in spite of the foolish things they do. Someday you may wake up and find you're a parent too.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, November 27th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many of the places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So, Michael, a few weeks ago, you made national news with your photo of what was reported to be Hillary Clinton, but it was Florence Henderson. And we had news this week that Florence Henderson has passed away, I think at the age of 82, was it?
Yes. Yeah.
So both of you have met and spoken with Florence. So why don't you tell us a little remembrance of her? Michael, go first.
Well, it was quite a shock to me, and I didn't even know that apparently she just this past Monday appeared on Dancing with the Stars, I'm told, in the audience. And she had previously been a contestant, but she was in the audience this past Monday, and that is live, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think it is. I don't watch it, but I think it is because it's voted on by the audience.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, excuse my ignorance of reality TV shows.
No,
but
I don't either.
But yeah, so I mean, in it, of course it's sad, but I guess it's one of those things where it seems that she really did not suffer at all. It seems it was very quick. It was reported as heart failure, which I don't know if that means heart attack. But apparently they had enough notice that her family could gather around her as they did when she passed. But she really was an amazing woman. One of those people with several acts to her career. She started out very young on Broadway. Her Broadway debut was in Wish You Were Here as the new girl. So I think that was pretty appropriate. She's the new girl in The Camp, but she was also new to Broadway. And then she was in Oklahoma in 1953 at City Center. And then she was the lead in Fanny, which is a really beautiful musical that's, I guess, maybe hasn't withstood the test of time as much as some others, but really beautiful. And Encores did it several years ago, and it was great to see that. And her voice on that recording is just gorgeous. And then she was in the Noel Coward musical, The Girl Who Came to Supper. And then she did the revival of South Pacific that it was at the New York State Theater at Lincoln Center in 1967, which yielded a really wonderful cast album, which Miss Henderson would point to in later years when people the terminology varies, but a lot of people were saying that the Lincoln Center theater revival of South Pacific with Kelly O'Hara and Paula Schott, etc., was the first Broadway revival. And technically, it may have been, in the sense of that production was done on Broadway contracts and was Tony eligible. But the South Pacific at the New York State Theater was obviously a huge major production on the same campus as it, you know, as it turns out, as the Lincoln Center Theater production. So regardless of what the terminology is, it's that's a wonderful album that you should pick up if you don't have it. She really had a wonderful, beautiful voice and was a very, very funny woman. She I always thought it's interesting that she, of course, gained tremendous fame and immortality in a sense through the Brady Bunch, playing Carol Brady on TV on the Brady Bunch. She did not, in her case, then use that fame as a vehicle for a return to Broadway. I'm thinking maybe because of family obligations, children, etc. But that's something she might have done, which she did not do. However, she had a wonderful later career, television, films, commercials, and she I also saw her do a club act in 2007, I believe. In fact, that was the first time I really did a major interview with her. She really was great and a wonderful supporter of the gay and lesbian community. She did that photo of to which James referred was a photo from Broadway Backwards, the annual show in which men sing songs written for women and vice versa. And it was a shot from a production number of There's Nothing Like a Dame, Gender Reversed, that Miss Henderson did in Broadway Backwards. So she is really going to be missed. It's as several people have pointed out, 2016 has been a very bad year in many ways. We've lost some incredible people, and she's definitely one of them.
Now, Peter, do you have anything to say about Florence?
Yeah, I had a nice time interviewing her once. I asked her a good deal about Wish You Were Here, and when she was still able to recite the one line she had in that show. That was 1952. She was 18 years old, and she was very lucky in the sense that Joshua Logan got involved with Fanny because he directed Wish You Were Here, and as a result, he was able to say, you know, this girl would be good, because up until that time, they were really thinking of using, and I'm serious about this, Judy Garland. So Logan joined forces with David Merrick, saying, I will be part of this production, but I must co-write the libretto and I must co-produce with you. And David Merrick was essentially just starting out. He had to take those terms. So she pointed out what a big break that was since he knew her. She also talked a good deal about The Girl Who Came to Supper, which was the Noel Coward musical she was in. And she remembers vividly being in Philadelphia for the tryout when word came that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated. She said, I remember being in that elevator. I'll never forget that somebody told me in the elevator, and I had to worry about our opening number, Long Live the King if He Can, a song about assassination, which had to be changed in a hurry. So there was that as well. And after we talked about South Pacific, I said, have I set the record for being the interviewer that's taken the longest to bring up the Brady Bunch? And she said, absolutely. Oh, I'm so glad to hear somebody ask questions about my Broadway career rather than that. But she was proud to have been on the Brady Bunch. And she did say, you know, I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, may I give you a hug? May I hug you? That she was so maternal in that way that they really responded to her in that fashion. And, you know, also what really has to be said is this girl came from a farm she was one of 10 children, and she just had this wonderful voice that was discovered by nuns. So many people really get their start in church, singing in church, and she was one of them. And there was an opera diva, I don't remember who it was, so it was somebody famous who heard her and said, this girl deserves a break, and she mentored her to get her seen and heard, and that really launched her career. So the thing she told me she's always asked is whether or not she slept with Barry Williams, because there were rumors going around saying that she had. She said she did not. So we will take her word for that and remember her fondly and wish that she had come back to Broadway. I always expected that she would after Brady Bunch, as Michael implied there, that we were a little surprised that she didn't. But I guess we'll just have to play our cast albums that we have of her and be very grateful that we have them.
you know, we'll have to live with the cast albums. Did you ask her, Peter? I always thought it was interesting in Wish You Were Here, that character of the new girl literally does not appear till the last like 3 minutes of the show. And I'm thinking that maybe she actually did not appear until that point either. And maybe, I mean, it would be unusual to have that happen, but maybe she was also an understudy and just sat around for the rest of the show in order to have the effect of somebody new coming on who we hadn't seen before. I don't know if you addressed that specifically with
her. I didn't know that at all. So this is news to me that she showed up late. She didn't tell me that. So no, I don't know.
Yeah, because I did a production. I may have mentioned I did a production of it on Fire Island some years ago, and actually I played that role because we had a lot of doubling, and some of it was cross gendered, and yeah, she just comes in at the very end. It's supposed to be kind of the changing of the guard, you know, the people, the new people arriving at the camp as the old ones are leaving. And yeah.
Did you have a swimming pool?
No, we did. the entire stage was smaller than a swimming pool. I remember at one point one character is supposed to be thrown in the pool, and what we had to do was he went off stage and somebody got a bit of water and splashed it all over him, and then he walked on.
If it's good enough for Leona Samish, it's good enough for him. Okay,
exactly.
Good.
Seems to happen a lot in Fire Island shows.
Yeah. Well, it's hot, so.
All right. So, Michael and Peter, both of you got a chance to get down to the Vineyard Theater to see This Day Forward. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, this is Nikki Silver's new play, and it deals with a situation we wouldn't expect in real life, but that's what Nikki Silver is for. He does that all the time for us, surprises us. So it's the wedding night of a newly married couple, and of course the husband fully expects that he's going to have sex with his wife. Instead, she tells him that she's never really loved him, and that the person she's really loved is going to show up here. Well, that's a real complication, needless to say. So that's basically the first act. The second act, we see them many, many moons later. And what we do see is this woman all grown up, an older woman now, and a mother, and not a very nice mother. Nikki Silva's very good at writing not-so-nice mothers. And she certainly wants to have her say in what people should be saying and doing because she is that type of mother. I wish I could be more enthusiastic, but I didn't much like this at all. We talked about a Billy Bigelow moment in falsettos a few weeks ago. I'm sorry to say there's one here as well. So that's going to be hard for some people to really get behind. It's so hard to know what this play is about. It bounces around like a game of Pong, if you remember Pong from years ago. That's what I really felt like. It was going on one side, the other side, up, down, over, around, all the prepositions you can think of. So it doesn't really land anywhere that and the real problem for me was the husband, who was so in love with the wife in the first act. I don't understand why he is, because she's so ditzy, so amazingly ditzy. So, but the play does have a theme about the ramifications of a bad marriage, and it does indicate if you marry in haste, you will repent in leisure. So that much is clear, but boy, when you finally realize that that's the point of it, a lot of time has passed. And while June Gable is awfully good, first as a maid of the hotel suite in the first act, and then as the mother in the second, this is a hard evening to recommend.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I liked it lot less than Peter.
I
screwed it up. I should have used your version of the line. Peter liked it a lot more than I did.
All right.
I thought it was appallingly bad. That thing you said about the play bouncing around a lot, it's interesting. When I saw The Lions, the Nikki Silver play The Lions, I thought, and I believe I said at the time, it seemed very much to me like it was two completely different plays stitched together, because each one maybe had not been finished or each one wasn't a full-length play. And I very much felt the same with this one. I think that there were two different plays, and then he tried to figure out a way to make it seem like the young bride in Act One is the woman who turns into the old lady who nobody wants anymore in Act Two. I could be completely wrong, but I absolutely had that idea, and nobody told me, you know, I mean, I never read or heard anything about this in the case of either play, but that's what I think. I would say further than Ditzy, I think that in Act One, this young bride, Irene, played by Holly Fain in Act One, is so hateful, so inconsiderate, so selfish, and that, you know, I sensed tremendous hatred for her from the audience, almost to the point where the Billy Bigelow moment seemed motivated. You know, I mean, we won't get into that, but it's like this is a despicable person. And it's funny because in the very first few moments of the first act, I thought it was going to be a comedy. and I thought it was going to – I didn't know how it was going to end up, but I thought, well, this has got to, you know, be a joke that she – oh, she's – it's her wedding night, and she's chooses that moment to tell this this man whom she's just married that she not only doesn't love him but is in love with somebody else. I mean why would she do that? Why would she choose that moment? It's just – just ridiculous.
Michael, I will tell you this, that I dare say that the audience response, I'm talking about the applause at the end, has to be the weakest I've experienced in a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot of people must be agreeing that she's hateful more than Ditzy.
I noticed that too. I absolutely did. To clarify, the only let's see, is this true? The only character who actually carries forward from Act One to Act Two is the one we're discussing, Irene, played by Holly Fain in Act One and by June Gable in Act Two. Michael Crane, who plays the bridegroom in Act One, then in Act Two plays the son of those two people, who, as it turns out, they do remain married at least for a while, and they have children. And then June Gable in Act One plays a maid at the hotel, and then in Act Two, as we said, she plays Irene. And there are several other actors that work into it, but the friend with whom I went hated it almost as much as me, but he did say that he found Act Two more interesting in terms of subject matter, and I would agree with that in terms of subject matter alone, because Act Two is basically about the fact that Irene is now an old lady, and the question is, who is she going to live with? And her children don't want her because probably largely because she's such an awful, awful person. Oh, Act Two also, at one point, it got to a point where every other word was fuck. Mm-hmm. And I had a vocal reaction to it after like the 12th fuck, because I've always said that that's what a playwright does when he's desperate and has no idea what else to do. We've discussed before, I think there is something to be said for a theater company having loyalty to playwrights, mm-hmm. but not to this extent. When it gets to the point where you're going to produce something that's completely worthless by an established writer, rather than giving a chance to a talented up-and-coming person, I think that's a very, very unfortunate thing.
Hollywood's multi-picture deal contracts may have come into play here. So
Oh, and in the case of the Lions, as I should say, I did feel, again, that that was two plays put together. But in that case, I thought one of the plays was really good and the other one was not. The one that featured Linda Lavin in the main, you know, as the main focus, I thought that was a really good play. But in this case, I would say they're both really awful.
Okay, so I am getting caught up with a number of shows that have opened up. And last week, Michael and Peter talked about Finian's Rainbow at Irish Rep, and I actually went to see it last night.
Ah.
And I just wanted to weigh in for a second that that I really enjoyed this production. And I think that Peter and Michael have covered pretty much everything that that I would have said about it. I just wanted to add on that Mark Evans as Og is doing a really great job, and this there's a woman, what was her name, Lyrica Woodruff. She did Susan the Silent, and I kept on thinking to myself, somebody do a revival of Carousel so she could play Louise.
That would be a nice idea. I agree.
Yeah, we discussed the political content of Finian's Rainbow a little bit, but I don't think we mentioned, and it goes by so quickly. It's in a lyric in the Begat, and it goes by so quickly that there's really not a chance for the audience to really react. But there's that line about the misbegotten GOP.
Yeah.
And needless to say.
That got cheers last night.
Did it?
Yeah, it did.
Do you know, and parenthetically, I was reminded of this the other night because I was listening to several recordings of Finian's Rainbow, including the soundtrack. Do you know that they changed that line for the movie?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
You know, I don't know if this was like a similar thing to Richard Nixon in 1776 and Considerate Men, but it was 1968. And it was a time of when isn't, but it was a time of political conflict. And in the movie, it was a Warner Brothers movie, so that would be the same Jack Warner who cut Cool, Considerate Men. Well, let's see, was he still at Warner's in '68?
Well, 1776 came later, so
yeah. But that was he actually did that as an independent.
Oh, right, that was a Columbia movie. You're right. Absolutely right.
Well, I'm sorry, I should have looked that up. But regardless, the line was changed in the movie, and instead of the misbegotten GOP, believe it or not, they say it's not completely clear, but I'm pretty sure they say the misbegotten VIP. So I just think that's so interesting that they felt it necessary to change that incredible Harburg lyric in that moment in passing in that song, just to not get anybody upset in the audience in 1968.
So, one of the other things I wanted to ask the two of you about, and you might be different because you might have been to early press performances, that there was a lot of children at the Irish Rep last night. And, you know, teens, early teens type of things who were bored out of their minds. They were not engaged. And I was wondering why do parents always bring children to Finian's Rainbow? Do they feel like it's a show that is a children's show or?
Yeah, I can understand why that title might suggest some sort of kiddie appropriate material.
Maybe they hear that there's a leprechaun in it and they think it's.
Yeah, that's true too.
Yeah. So it was interesting because we were sitting in a row with a few teens who wished they were somewhere else.
That's too bad.
That's totally too bad because I was like, you have Melissa Errico and Ken Jennings and some other wonderful people just feet from you. That you normally would never get this opportunity to see this type of talent so close to you and in such a small, intimate venue. I was sad for them. But
And that score, too. Frankly, I heard it when I was a teenager, and it certainly overwhelmed me. I was crazy for it. It was one of the first cast albums I ever got, and I adored it. So anyway, that's the difference between them and me, so who knows who's right. Anyway,
I think that Finian's Rainbow quite possibly could have been the first musical I ever saw.
Ah, wow.
I saw it at Jones Beach.
Monday is still here. Oh, I saw it there too.
Saw it at Jones Beach. I can't even begin to imagine what the year was. Would you know, Peter?
I would guess 78, 79, 80 at the latest. But I saw it too out there. Charlie Rapley played the leprechaun. That comes back. So I imagine that was the same production. Of course, they may have done it more than once, but I have a feeling that was the same one.
James, I totally agree with you about Mark Evans and the Irish Rep production. Our listener, Debbie Schrager, wrote to point out that Mark was excellent when The Fix was done.
Yeah, that's right.
Down in D.C. area. So I hope to see a lot more of him, definitely.
All right. So, Peter, you got a chance to see the death of the last black man in the whole entire world. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is Susan Laurie Parks' new play. Now, Susan Laurie Parks certainly became famous some years ago for winning a Pulitzer Prize, but she also was famous for writing 365 plays in 365 days. Hmm. Now, many of them, needless to say, were just a few lines long. And in this new play of hers, I think should have been one of those plays, or may have even been one of those plays. I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised if indeed this is an expansion of one of those little plays. The Death of the Last Black Man in the Whole Entire World, also known as if that title isn't long enough, The Negro Book of the Dead. So that's almost a one of the 365 plays in itself, the title alone. You know, I have to say I was reminded of the Dick Van Dyke Show while watching this play, and I know that sounds odd, but in one episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show, they go to an off-Broadway play, at least Laura Petrie does. She goes to an off-Broadway play, and a guy comes on carrying a watermelon and starts this very avant-garde type of speech. In fact, the very nuts and bolts Buddy Sorrell, played by Maury Amsterdam, said, "Avant-garde, that's off-Broadway garbage." Well, that's a little simplistic, needless to say. Of course, those are his values. But here we've come full circle, because here we are with a guy holding a watermelon during much of the show. So the title tells it all, really. And I really believe even at 70 minutes, it's much too long. Like they always say about book proposals, so many times when people submit book proposals, you know, I think it'd make a good article. Well, this would make a tiny play, because in many instances it reminded me also of Constantine's play In the Seagull, which is obtuse and abstract and lousy, you know. So I'm afraid this one here, while its intentions are wonderful in trying to illustrate that Black Lives Matter, no argument there. It's not done in a way that makes you say, oh, I get the point, as directly as other plays have done it. And it is a line and a party line that we've heard before too many times. So trying to do it in this different way may have been nicely ambitious on Susan Laurie Parks' part. But even at 70 minutes, boy, it was a long hour and 10.
All right. So that is playing through December 18th down at the Signature. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael, you got out to Northport on Long Island to the Yangman Theater to see Mary Poppins. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, I had seen several shows at the Yangman that I really liked. And then, I don't know, it seemed to me that maybe the train schedule changed for a while. And I don't know, maybe they were doing track work. I wanted to go back to see some other things, and it just didn't seem to work out in terms of being able to get there and back on any kind of a decent schedule. But recently it seems to have changed again, and now one can do that. So I arranged to go with a friend of mine to see Mary Poppins, mostly because I know the fellow who's playing Bert. His name is Luke Hawkins, and he's a tremendously talented dancer, actor, and singer. And That's really the primary reason why I went, because honestly, I never liked the stage adaptation of Mary Poppins. Let's see. The credit is original music and lyrics by Richard M. Sherman and Robert B. Sherman. That's the really great stuff. Book by Julian Fellowes, not so good. New songs and additional music and lyrics, also not so good, by George Stiles and Anthony Drew. Co-created by Cameron McIntosh. So there you go. I think the movie is wonderful. I think there were things that needed to be done to it in order to adapt it to the stage. For example, one example is that the movie has almost no chorus in it and very little ensemble other than I guess the Step in Time number, which is a big hit and which fortunately has been retained. Anyway, regardless of my feelings about the adaptation, I wanted to go see it, to go to the Engelmann again and to see Luke. And they did a wonderful production of the show. The highlight was the supercalifragilisticexpialidocious number was choreographed by Drew Humphrey, who also directed the show. And he apparently had the idea to do it with the cast had blocks, like huge, much larger version of those blocks that kids play with that have letters on mm-hmm. on all eight sides of them or whatever. And they would place the blocks and turn them so that the various letters were showing as they were singing the letter. I can't tell you the tremendous boost that gave to this number. It was suddenly like a new show. All of the energy and the cleverness of it, the many kids in the audience, they were, I have to say, extremely well behaved throughout. One of the best behaved younger audiences I've ever seen in my life. But at that point, I really felt that people were really, really into it. They also enjoyed the other Sherman Brothers numbers because they're so great. Step in Time was fantastic. Luke was great in it. But this Drew Humphrey, we spoke with Luke afterwards, and we, my friend Kevin McInerney and I went to see the show, and we both were so thrilled by this supercalifragilistic number. And we asked Luke if that was Drew's idea or if someone else had come up with it before. And he said, no, that was him. So they get really, really good people at the Engelmann, and they have the full Monty, Jekyll and Hyde, and Oklahoma coming up. So put them on your radar if they're not already there. Because they really deserve to be, and it's not a bad trip now that the train schedule seems to have changed back again. You do still need to get a cab from the train station to and from, but it's about a, I don't know, maybe like a 9-minute ride. It's not too bad. So yes, Mary Poppins at the Engelmann.
Michael, you really don't like the song "Practically Perfect" that Drew and Stiles wrote? Boy, I'm crazy for that song.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, not for you. Okay.
I would say that it's I think the song itself is fine, but to me it's in the movie a spoonful of sugar is her establishing number, mm-hmm. and it's retained in the musical, but to move it later just seems so odd to me. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm so used to the original.
Mm-hmm. So your trip out there, Michael, was two buses and a train. Can you imagine that?
Can you say the least? That? I drove out there once and it took forever, so I know how hard it is to get out there. But I'm glad Michael feels it's worth the trip to see this Mary Poppins.
Yeah, it's not too bad. You have to change at on Jamaica? The train at Huntington, actually. Oh.
You always have to change it.
Change
it
to Jamaica,
Peter.
Right.
That's such a New York reference.
That it just, sure is. Just, it really is.
All right. So that's the John Engelmann Theater in Northport, New York, which is on the north shore of Long Island, sort of Nassau-Suffolk County border, and it's a fun time.
Oh, and it's a lovely – the Kevin was – I had told him beforehand how beautiful the theater is. It's, I believe, a renovated movie theater. But the lobby is so nice and pretty, and there's a grand piano in the lobby that I think they use sometimes for performances and music during intermissions and such. And it's the sidelines of the theater itself are wonderful, and it's really just a really wonderful place to see a show.
Michael, I might be mistaken, but I think that it was a legit theater converted to a movie theater, converted back to a legit theater.
I think you're right. Yeah, that sounds the history is. I should have refreshed myself, but there's a note about it in the playbill. So,
yeah. All right. So, a couple of days ago, I was hanging out down at Lafayette Street, and I looked up and I saw Michael, and we were both at the Public Theater, both seeing the same show. Which sometimes, you know, you're at the Public Theater. There's, you know, 5, 6, 7 theaters there, depending on how they subdivide everything. We both saw Sweat. So, Michael, you want to give us a little introduction on Sweat?
Yeah, I was really looking forward to this play by Lynn Nottage because of the subject matter. It's set in Reading, Pennsylvania, in various scenes between the year 2000 and 2008. And it's basically about these people who work in some kind of a factory, and they are experiencing what happens when downsizing occurs and when the economy is going south and when management is trying to pinch every last penny out of the business, and when they start to do that by laying people off and doing more automation. And unfortunately, what happens in this case is that this group of people, mixed races and ages and, you know, various – all different kinds of people, they're all very friendly with each other until all of that starts, and then they start to – turn on each other. And there's this one woman who gets promoted to management just before all of the shit hits the fan, if you would. And she is terribly conflicted about that because she is now on the opposite side of all of her friends, and some of them are calling her a scab because they eventually wind up going on strike. And things just go – let's just say things go from bad to much, much, much worse. I liked I liked everything about the play, except that I unfortunately have to say a lot of the dialogue didn't ring true to me. It sounded like there was a lot of speechifying from the characters. I thought that many of them spoke in ways that those actual people would not speak. Some of it sounded like soapboxy and almost like essays that one would write for a magazine or something like that. And that's too bad because I find the drama so compelling. I think it was a very worthy subject matter for Lynn Nottage to write about. And it's a wonderful production at the Public, sets by John Lee Beatty. Costumes by Jennifer Muller, lighting by Peter Kazarowski, and directed by Kate Worski, if I didn't mention that. Also, a very strong cast, Lance Cody Williams, Will Pullen, who is one of my favorite young actors, Chris Davis from The Royale. Will and Chris play two very close friends who eventually wind up suffering greatly because of what's happening. Carlo Alban, Michelle Wilson, James Colby, a wonderful actor who I had not seen in a long time. I saw him years ago in Streetcar as Stanley up at in New Haven. Joanna Day, Miriam Shore, and John Earl Jelks. So a lot of talent involved there. And I just wish that the dialogue to me had rung a little more true.
Michael, I'm incredibly thankful for your comment about the dialogue because I couldn't put it together what was bothering me about the show, and you've nailed it exactly. The speechifying is exactly because I happen to have spent a good deal of time in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
I did my undergraduate at Penn State University in University Park, State College, Pennsylvania, and had a lot of friends and, in fact, a roommate that lived in Reading. So I was back and forth to Reading a lot. And a lot of the story of sweat itself rings very true to many of these what they're calling Rust Belt towns in the Midwest, whether it be, you know, Reading or Johnstown or even closer to Pittsburgh. And they all had the USW shirts on, which is the United Steelworkers, which I'm assuming it was a steel fabrication plant, so they never got very specific about it. I think they would have Nottage would have really done well to bring in somebody to help the dialogue there, because this story is really compelling. And unfortunately, if you do not already have a ticket to the show, you're not going to see it because it's sold out and it doesn't seem like it's going to extend. Sweat was commissioned and originally produced by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as part of American Revolutions, the United States History Cycle. Is Oregon Shakespeare Festival the same people that commissioned All the Way? I think. Did you guys even know that?
I don't know, but I do know Bill Roush is doing a hell of a job out there. So.
Yeah. I mean, and as Michael was saying, this cast is really, really great.
Yes.
This story, that's the only thing that that was off, and you articulated it so well, Michael, is that the speechifying became a little grating on me, and I wish it had really not to the level of mammoth dialogue, but
yeah,
but perhaps.
I'm not saying that these people should be are stupid, but it's the vocabulary and the articulateness and the length of the speeches, it did not seem. And I hasten to add, I did not feel that way about either of Lynn Nottage's other two plays that I know really well, Ruined and Intimate Apparel. So I think she is a wonderful playwright overall. I just think, as you said, that that I wish that more attention had been given to that specific aspect of this play, because other than that, I think it's really wonderful and very, very powerful, and obviously something that deserves to be seen, especially at this time in our history.
And I think that this is the type of play and the type of cast that can be easily be done at many theaters around the country and around the world. In fact, whether it be community or college theaters or large regionals, I think that this is a show that I hope that we will be seeing popping up at various different places in the future.
I expect you will. We will.
So it's playing down at the Public, as I said, through December 18th. If you have tickets, look forward to that. Get your butt in those seats. And if not, let's hope that it shows up somewhere else. Peter got a chance to see Master Harold and the Boys down at – was it Signature?
Yeah, in the big theater. And I was there at a matinee where there were a lot of school kids, plenty of school kids, who wound up sleeping a good deal through the first half of the play. And I thought, okay, kids, get your rest, because I know that you're going to be engaged as time goes on. There's no question that this play by Ethel Fugard, and directed by Ethel Fugard too, takes its time to get going. It starts off, it takes place entirely in a tea room in South Africa, where indeed there are no customers because they're just preparing to open for that evening. And what we have is Sam, played by Leon Addison Brown, and Willie, played by Sao Nagura. And they're the employees, they're the hired hands, and in comes Hallie, the young boy who they've known since he was a baby. He is the son of the owners of the tea room, and they've always liked him. But, you know, he's getting older and he's feeling his oats and he gets very imperious. One of the ironies is that early on in the play, he says people can be real bastards. Well, he'll prove it later that he can be too. Noah Robbins, an actor who is astonishingly good in everything I've seen him in. This may be his apotheosis. He is magnificent as this little, you should pardon the expression, Nazi, who really bosses these people around. He needs them as friends, and that's when he needs them as friends, he's very nice to them, but he really sets a lot of boundaries that he even enjoys when they're stepping over so that he can castigate them. So he has a wonderful hands and pockets cockiness that's really quite impressive. But there's a lot of talk that seems to go nowhere for the longest time. Every time the phone rings, and it will, you're so grateful saying, okay, now something's going to happen. And something does. What's happening is that Harold's father is in the hospital. He's been quite ill for quite some time, and now he's in the hospital, and it looks like he's getting out today. And Harold doesn't want that because he sees his father as a burden and an embarrassment because the father has a very serious illness that's very discernible to anybody who looks at him. So he tries to pretend on the phone that indeed his issue is, no, we don't want him coming home too soon because, oh, he's just not ready yet. No, he just wants that guy out of the house. That's all there is to it. And he's very embarrassed that the phone conversations last as long as they do with his mother because the two guys are seeing him and he's revealing himself and he doesn't want to be revealed that way. So he hates that they overhear them and that they've essentially found him out. So that's a big problem. Now, this is a show that really deals with displaced hostility because indeed when he doesn't get his own way and it looks like his father is coming home from the hospital, that's when he becomes severe towards these guys. And that's when the play really perks up. And that's when these kids suddenly were awake and paying rapt attention. It takes the play is only about 90 minutes long, no intermission. But I will say that for the first 70 minutes, maybe even 75, it seems like you're really at a talk fest where nothing's going to happen at all. So, but boy, does that last scene crackle. And Noah Robbins gives one of the finest performances I've seen this season. And so does Leon Addison Brown as Sam. Mr. Nagora, Willie, doesn't have nearly as much to do and isn't put on the carpet as much as Sam is. So his role is less potent. But it's really a fine, fine show. And I will admit that Noah Robbins reminded me a great deal, both in build and looks, of Lonnie Price, who played the part originally on Broadway when he took over Bjelto Ivanic, who got a film when the show was in New Haven. And, of course, Lonnie Price is in the news now and certainly made our podcast last week when we talked about the wonderful job he's done with the movie Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened, about the making and breaking of Merrily We Roll Along. But he's very much in that mold. And if you saw the play in 1980, you'll be reminded of Lonnie Price here. And if you didn't see it in 1982, I bet that Noah Robbins really knocks you out.
You know, Peter, as I'm sure you remember, there was a TV production of the play with Matthew Broderick. I'm not sure if that is still available. I'm trying to look for it now. But that was my first experience of the play. And no, I'm sorry, I guess it must have come after I saw it on Broadway with Lonnie Price. But if anyone can find that, I highly recommend it. This is probably really stupid of me. I purposely did not arrange to see this current production of Master Harold, only for the reason that it's one of the most painful plays I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And I just did not feel up to it at that time.
I understand.
what has been going on
I understand.
In the world, in the country. But I can imagine that with all those people, it's really fantastic and probably even more painful because of the excellence of all those people involved. And am I incorrect? Didn't Fugard himself direct this production?
Yes. Yes, indeed he did. He did.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, if you have never seen it, please do go. It's very, very, very sad. I think it's brilliant how Fugard makes the point that people who are bigoted in one way or another, people who hold irrational hatred like that, often it stems from something that is completely different. You know, in this case, Hallie's feelings about his father and his extreme distress over all that, I think, are largely responsible for him lashing out eventually at one of the one of these black men who who has been almost a surrogate father figure for him, and it's
absolutely yeah. surrogate, yes,
yeah, and so painful.
You know, I'm also reminded of a play I saw at Theater East, which is at which uses urban stages on 30th Street, A Name for a Ghost to Mutter, by Cindy Williams, because there's a lot of displaced hostility in this play as well. This one takes place down south, where we're going through a person's effects after she has died, and the relatives are there to see what's there. And there's much more there than they expected to find, much more indeed. And they don't know quite what to do with everything they find. I know I'm being purposely enigmatic because I don't want to give too much away. But what I will say is that while the play doesn't satisfy me nearly as much as I wanted it to, and the ending is very unpersuasive, I thought the acting was really excellent. It was so nice to see David Volan, an actor I've known from my days at the Star Ledger. He acts in New Jersey quite a bit. To see him really being very effective here as the one man in the middle of all these women going through all these intimate apparel things, as well as a great deal of other ones as well. I also have to credit Emily Verla, who is a person we actually meet. Even though she dies, we have a lot of flashbacks to see what was on her mind. So good acting, not such good a play, but I like this company, Theater East. I think when they say complex stories simply told, that's their motto. And I think this is a company to watch for, because the direction by Judson Jones was really sparkling. So I wish the script had been stronger, but I am glad that I did get to see it.
Let me slip in. I was checking, and I don't believe that the Matthew Broderick Master Harold is available in any decent form through Amazon, except maybe on VHS. But the whole thing is viewable on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
oh.
So, there's also a did you see this, Peter? A 2010 film, theatrical film version with Freddie Highmore and Ving Rhames?
I know a great deal about that because okay. Lonnie Price directed that, and he was contracted to teach at Yale that semester. And he said, please, to me, will you substitute teach for me the first three while I direct the movies? So, I was a sub at Yale while he was busy elsewhere making this movie. The movie's very effective. I mean, but Lord knows he knows the territory. And he directed that revival in 2003 on Broadway as well, where he cast someone very different in type. The actor he chose was, in fact, the actor who was in China Doll last year with Al Pacino. So a big, beefy guy. You know, so he wanted to do something very different. He didn't want to cast anybody who looked very much like him, I guess. But it really works when you have a little guy there, you know, being such a despot and not a benevolent one at all.
Well, I'm updating your bio to say professor
right.
of theater
that's right.
at Yale. That's
right.
At the top of every podcast, I'm going to mention that.
That's a good idea.
All right. So that's Master Harold and the Boys, which is playing down at Signature's Irene Diamond Stage, which is the big one, through December 11th.
Which is surprising. You know, frankly, when I heard Sweet Charity was going to be done in that complex, I expected yeah. it to be on the big stage. And I expected Master Harold, the three-character play, to be in the space that Sweet Charity's in. Mm. Live and learn.
All right. So to wrap up for this morning, just quickly, I got down to the public theater and saw Women of a Certain Age, which is part of Richard Nelson's works, and Women of a Certain Age is set on the evening of the election that has just passed, which made me think about it. And I was wondering when exactly they finished the show. Because when Nelson finished writing the show, did Peter have or Michael, have you heard about were they did they have two shows written or how they got up to?
Well, I just wanted to clarify, is that the show that was also performed on election night?
Yeah,
I think
it's running from November 4th to December 4th, so. So it's actually started before election night.
There's very little in the play about the election. It's astonishingly little. And but I saw it on the Friday after the election, and I wonder if cuts were made. I have no idea.
I read somewhere that he was making changes right up until the night of the election.
Mm-hmm. Which makes me think about a comment that was made earlier about some theaters being so dedicated to a writer that they will produce a show sight unseen, you know, because this was written up until the very last moment. At least the other night when I saw it, there were some very topical references in there that would have only been known to you at the night of the election itself. Mm-hmm. So, a really great cast, Meg Gibson, Lynn Hawley, Roberta Maxwell, Marianne Plunkett, J.O. Sanders, Anne Warren, six-person cast. And this is a family that is seemingly going through a lot of transition. I won't really blow the storyline for you there. This is, you know, less about politics and just happens to be set on the evening of the election and more about interpersonal relationships and the complexities. And I kept on thinking of the meal that they were making on stage, seemingly, actually real. You could smell it as they're cooking it on stage. seemingly thinking that this is a very similar to The Humans, a different take on family interpersonal dynamics. And I think that if you have seen and are a fan of the other Richard Nelson plays, this might be a play for you. And so check it out if you'd like it. There's a link to it in the show notes, and they have a lot of information and some videos on it to check that out down at the Public.
I read a report somewhere that from someone who was at the show on election night, and they said it was – I mean, you can only imagine. At the point that they went in, I guess there was really no clue as to what was going to happen. And then as they emerged from the show, somebody said something like, "It's not good." And then they had to walk through the lobby, and there was all this I guess there were the TV set up and people were watching, and it was extremely upsetting.
All right. So that's it so far for this week. You guys have anything else you want to throw in before we wrap up?
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio. This is a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to get us in iTunes. You can get us in many ways. iHeartRadio plays us, iTunes, Google Play, and anywhere else that you can find finer podcasts, as well as the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry. Oh, you know, your iPhone, your Android device, no longer the BlackBerries. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com as well. So, Peter, what's the answer to last week's trivia?
Well, the question was, the opening number of a Sondheim musical actually happens to mention the title of a previous Sondheim musical. What's the name of the song and both Sondheim shows? Well, in Company, we hear Joanne and Larry in the opening title song sing, "Bob, We're Having People In Saturday Night." And Saturday Night was indeed the title of a previous Sondheim show. Father John Petrikovic was the first to get it, followed by Jack Lechner, Bethany Sulecki, and Robert Lobiondo, who told me he was having trouble figuring out the answer until his cell phone rang. You see, because his first name is Robert, he's programmed his ringtone to be Bobby, 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 baby, Bobby, Bobby, Robbie, to Robert, darling. So when he heard that riff, the answer occurred to him. Yeah, so as for Jack Lechner, yes, he did get the answer, but he did it the hard way. For he started with Sondheim's most recent musical, Roadshow, and he went in time backwards. And Company, of course, is early in the career. This is undoubtedly a tribute to Merrily We Roll Along that went backwards in time, too. Perhaps Jack saw the best worst thing that ever could have happened, the terrific new film about Merrily, and that's why he started with Roadshow as opposed to starting with A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. That's the answer to that. All right, the new one. Many musicals tell the story of a family. Sometimes the actors who play fathers win Tonys, such as Zero Mostel and Fiddler. Sometimes actresses who play mothers win, such as Alice Ripley in Next to Normal. Sometimes actors and actresses who play children win, such as John Gallagher Jr. in Spring Awakening and Anika Noni Rose in Carolina Change. But what musical saw the entire family get Tony Awards?
Wow.
All right. So if you know about that, send us an email at triviabroadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantiere and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm an optimist, and I can't get it into my head. I hear the human race is falling on its face and hasn't very far to go. But every whippoorwill is selling me a bill and telling me it just ain't so. I could say life is just a bowl of Jell-O and appear more intelligent and smart, but I'm stuck like a dope with a